All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right. And I was just fooling to see who was actually listening, okay? Anyway, welcome to the show. At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking to Menachem Daum and Oren Radovsky, the filmmakers of a film called The Ruins of Lifta, where the Holocaust and the Nakba meet. Lifta is the only Arab village abandoned in the 1948 Arab-Israeli War that has not been completely destroyed or repopulated by Jews. And actually, let's not say just Jews, Zionists, okay? Let's talk about that. And it's a place that caused Menachem Daum to begin to question all the things that he had been told his entire life. It's a fascinating film, and it's going to be a great discussion, I think. Opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Noche Diaz. And Noche is coming to us to talk about the Get Into the Revolution National Organizing Tour. And Noche was viciously assaulted and arrested by University of Chicago police on Wednesday, October 26. He was delivering the message that America was never great. We need to overthrow, not vote for this system. And moments before, he was violently assaulted and arrested as he was peacefully leaving campus North Residential Commons. Police assaulted others, sending one young woman to the hospital. Noche, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Sure, man. It's good to talk to you again. Well, let's jump into this because I want to get as much out of it as we can. All right. I mentioned a little bit about the tour, but why don't we start with you giving people a picture of the tour? What is it? An overall picture of the tour. What is it?
That's a very important, you know, I want people listening to understand the national scope of this tour. We've kicked off, started here in Chicago with very specific objectives, and we've been accomplishing, you know, very important things and learning a lot. But people should get a sense that this tour is going to be for the next year, going around the country, spreading this message of revolution. You know, there's a statement that went up on RevCom from the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party that states in clear terms, we're organizing now to overthrow this system as soon as possible, and we have a way to win, to really make a revolution. And this tour is on a mission over the next year to, you know, go throughout the country, to cities and towns, places where the revolution has strength and places where we're not known yet, and actually organize into the ranks of this revolution, the thousands. And because if you really think about making a revolution, it's not going to happen in one or a few cities. It's got to be a society-wide movement of people who are working on the problems of the revolution, getting connected up with the leadership of Bob Avakian and the Revolutionary Communist Party, and getting organized to work together to bring the days closer when we can actually go for an all-out struggle to take power over society and put an end to this system.
We're going to talk more about the tour itself, and in particular, I want to talk about that last point there, the point that you were just making about what's sort of different about this tour in terms of it not just being a tour to familiarize people with the revolution, but actually actively organizing people into the revolution. I think that's actually something that's extremely important right now. And in terms of, it struck me as everything I was reading about the tour was meant, as people were talking about what they're doing, you can actually see how there's a struggle to bring people into this and into the movement for revolution overall, but to do it in a way that actually, you know, is increasing the forces for revolution, which has a very important thing in relation to both the need to build the movement for revolution and two, especially in terms of what's going on in the world today. So let's talk about that a little.
Sure. So, I mean, as you said, this is and as we've been repeating, this is an organizing tour. This is not a speaking tour. This is not just a spread the word tour, as, you know, important as things like that are. This is a tour to organize now people into the ranks of this revolution, to transform the relationship between people who are supportive of the revolution to becoming people who are actually part of taking responsibility for the revolution. And everybody does have responsibility, including the people listening right now. We'll get more to later, I guess, about what's going on right now in the world. But, you know, even when we launched this tour, the sharpening of just what's going on everywhere, you know, from the ongoing police murders and mass incarceration of black people and Latinos to the refugee crisis haunting the Middle East and Europe, you know, which everyone sees the pictures from Syria, but they don't see what the U.S. is doing in Yemen, carrying out, you know, equal war crimes and crimes against humanity there. And then you come here and you see the situation for women being degraded and disrespected and just brutalized. You know, rape is not even a serious crime anymore in this country. And we can go on and on about the, you know, the immigration crisis where, you know, here where people are just being hunted, hounded, scapegoated, and blamed by both candidates for president, by the way, and, you know, and demonized and gone after in horrific ways. All of this is part of a system that is absolutely irreformable, is contemptible, is disgusting, is inhumane. And everyone who sees that and wants to see an end to it, they have a responsibility to do the work of what's actually at the root of all this. What is the history of this country, and what is it going to take to actually put an end to this? And this revolution has actually got serious answers. And we're going to people not saying, hey, we're going to do this for you. You know, we're going to work, and we have these projects that would help you out. This is going to people and telling them straight up what the truth is, what needs to be done, and their responsibility in relationship to that. People have to change what they're about. They can't just continue to go on just looking at their own lives and trying to figure out themselves and just try to get by in a messed up world while this world continues to mess up, mess over, and destroy millions and billions of real people. So this, you know, this focus of the tour is to actually organize people into those ranks, and that means transforming how people understand their role and their responsibility in relationship to what they know or can come to know and be wanting to know about what, you know, what's going on in the world and what gives rise to all this. And well, the second part of your question, which I've now forgotten.
We'll bring it back. We'll bring it back. Don't worry about it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Noche Diaz from the Revolution Club, and he is currently touring the country as part of the Get Into the Revolution National Organizing Tour. And Noche was viciously assaulted recently and arrested by the University of Chicago police, and he has since been banned for life from the grounds of the University of Chicago. All that for delivering the message to the students that America was never great. We need to overthrow, not vote for this system.
Well, let's talk about what you were just saying, because, again, this is talking about the critical stakes that are involved in all this. And I was really, you know, I was reading on revcom.us, I was reading a piece by Sansara Taylor that talked about experience that people had had going out and talking to people. And some of the summations that people were making were pretty jolting if you think about, like, what has been going on in sort of not just the movement that you're involved in, that I'm a supporter of and all this, and not just that, but in terms of across the board, there has always been this sort of like the revolutionaries or the politicos go out and they put out some information, and then people will ask some questions, and then they'll go back and they'll have time to think about it, or people will say, look, we'll call you, you know, next week, or we'll call you as soon as we get done this. Instead, there seems to be a real emphasis on the time is now and you need to step forward. It's critically important. Let's talk about why that's so.
Right. So, there's two things to say about that. One, as I started, we do have this statement, How We Can Win, that just came out from the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which really puts the whole revolution right there in one place that lays out why we need this revolution and what we need to do now to get ready for the time when we can fight all out to win and how we would wage that kind of a struggle under those circumstances. And it really is long past time for us to be dilly-daddling and collecting phone numbers and getting back to people and hoping that people will figure it out on their own. Look, it's just we already know some things that, so long as this system goes on, it's going to constantly pull people in their daily lives to just do anything but take responsibility for what it's going to take to change the whole world. We actually have to be fighting to transform people on the spot, to bring them into the ranks of the revolution, and then can bring them into a process where it's not all, 0 to 60. If you don't decide to commit your whole life day one, then you've got no place in this revolution. But you do have to make a decision right now. It's not just nice conversation. Let's keep it going. And someday, maybe 10, 20 years from now, I'll think about joining the revolution or whatever. It's like this has got to be, again, people who, not just who those who suffer the worst hell, but them and also people who don't want to see this continue to go on. Actually, have to start being the ones taking responsibility for it. So we have this, we have this message, we have this statement which lays a lot of this out. And then there's the time right now. It's actually just way past time for people to think that anything short of being really serious and scientific about the problem and the solution is going to cut it. We'll get to the arrests later, but, I was at the University of Chicago spreading this message that America was never great. We need to overthrow, not vote for this system. And I come out, after being arrested to see what's going on in Standing Rock and the continuation of this genocide against the Native peoples and the destruction of our environment, this ruthless crackdown and repression that's going on against people there. It's absolutely sickening. And it's way too late for people to just be sort of holding their nose and hoping that some savior is going to come. We look at the Trump-Hillary thing. It's like you can't even keep up with the outrageous things that's coming out every day in relationship to that campaign. And both of these candidates are absolutely monstrous. Donald Trump, we don't have to spend a lot of time talking about how monstrous he is. He says it himself all the time. But then Hillary Clinton is actually no better. And, again, going back to Standing Rock, she just, the youth sent the delegation to New York to her office to try to bring, the word of what was going on there and to ask for support and deliver this letter. And they had the police sicked out on them, and they were totally rebuked, a big fuck you to them. This is what's going on. This is just a small example, but, you have this war criminal up against a fascist. and huge stakes going on in the world right now. The, you know, you look at the European unity that came out of World War II is breaking down. You know, the massive 65 million refugees in the Middle East, you know, flooding Europe and other places. This is like, the world is in massive convulsions. Ongoing murder by police here has not stopped or slowed down one bit. It's actually intensified, and the legal justifications have gotten worse and worse. And both people running for office have promised more of that and more, you know, bringing the, you know, police and the community closer together. I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry to go on and on.
No,
but look, the time is now. And the stakes are way too high and way too serious. But what's going on in the world? What future we're going to get out of all this? Because things can get worse. And you see, you know, you see what's being whipped up and mobilized by the Trump side of the equation. People who, you know, I saw the New York Times yesterday had a whole article interviewing his supporters. His supporters are talking about revolution, but not the kind of revolution we're talking about. They're talking about the kind of fascist takeover that would bring things back to a more openly white supremacist America number one, you know, women hating phobic kind of society in more open terms and unapologetic terms. That's one possible resolution of all this. And things are bad enough already to need a revolution to actually put an end to this, where things are headed, how things are sharpening up. Our side of the equation, the actual revolution, the forces that are fighting to put an end to this system of oppression and exploitation, the forces led by Bob Avakian, who actually has a whole new framework for a new society that could put an end to all this, those have to get strengthened, and they have to grow now, not a few years from now. Now is the time. People need to be flooding these ranks in these revolutions.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Noche Diaz from the Revolution Club, and he is currently touring the country as part of the Get Into the Revolution National Organizing Tour. And Noche was viciously assaulted recently and arrested by the University of Chicago police, and he has since been banned for life from the grounds of the University of Chicago. All that for delivering the message to the students that America was never great, we need to overthrow, not vote for this system.
Well, now, tell me one thing. You've started this tour in Chicago, and as you were just talking about, all the things that people are facing, including the horrendous police murder of black and brown people all over the country. Chicago has been one of the most brutal cities in terms of these assaults on the people, this wanton police murder, and all kinds of new exposures coming out about the role of the police department in all this, and in their drug dealing and everything else. How do you speak to, because I think it's, you know, it's really important what you've been saying about the whole point of, look, we need a revolution. Not just, America's never been great, and we need, don't vote for this. For this system, we need to overthrow it, not vote for it. And how do you deal with that when people come up? Because, you know, people are going to come up to you and they're going to say, look, yes, I want to fight against police brutality. But you're taking it. What do you see as the relationship between that, between the overall purpose of the tour and the overall need for a movement for revolution and this question of fighting police brutality and murder?
Well, they're absolutely integrated. I mean, but we're not talking about organizing people into the ranks of a revolution that is going to sit around and just wait for one fine day. We're hastening while awaiting, and part of that is actually building up the strength of the people to resist the crimes of this system. We together with, you know, Gloria Pinex, whose son was murdered by Chicago PD, and the Revolution Club here in Chicago called for people to be out in the streets on October 22nd. That's where I was, you know, first arrested here, you know, together with three other people. You know, we were attacked in a permitted march, you know, and then as we've been out here also going into the neighborhoods and talking to people, we actually are saying, look, the points of attention for the revolution that are, you know, available on RevCom that are in that statement, how we can win, these are the principles that we live, fight, and we would die by. And one of those points of attention says, you know, because we're serious about an actual revolution, we're not initiating acts of violence today, but we're not going to tolerate violence against the people. The way this system sends its police out to brutalize, harass, and terrorize people, it's way past time that people put up with that. And the revolution clubs are organized to live and fight for these principles that actually stand up to that. And as we've been out in these neighborhoods, we've confronted and challenged the police and their right and their authority to do what they do to people. And this is part of what we call fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. It's a strategic approach. It's an overall process. It's not contained in any one event. But this point of, like, part of the organized forces is that right now we can actually go to work on building up resistance to the crimes of this system, challenging, yes, the police murder, but also the way people get caught up in playing this system's game of living and dying for nothing, killing each other off because people have no future. But and this revolution is giving people a purpose and a reason to live and fight for something that could be about emancipating not just ourselves, but people all over the world. So not putting up with the way people are, you know, carrying on doing this system's work of killing each other off instead of fighting the real enemy. Putting an end and standing up to and challenging and representing an authority that's in the face of all this women hating, all this, you know, pimping culture, all this, you know, ideas that the role of a man is to dominate and lord over women, and that women are just to be things to be used up and degraded as, you know, bitches, hoes, tots, squallies, whatever it is. All this that's all this system's way of thinking that keeps people trapped in this rat race. All of that needs to be challenged, and these revolution clubs are part of the organizations that represent authority in the face of all of that oppressive thinking, but also the actual oppressive actions of this system. And it's challenging, not just challenging in an indefinite way, but it's challenging as part of contending for an actual revolution as soon as possible that can overthrow the system that has the authority and the power to enforce this way of life on people. And that's part of getting organized now, that these clubs are actually being grown and built up as a key component of the organized forces of this revolution. People who are representing with that Bob Avakian speaks, revolution, nothing less, sure, representing for the leadership we have and the points of attention for the revolution, how we live and fight today, and asserting that authority in the neighborhoods, asserting that authority on the campuses, up in the face of all this, you know, especially, you know, this rape culture on the campuses and all this, you know, monstrous, you know, kind of situation for women. But all of that is part of actually building up the forces for revolution now, and what they can do now to hasten the development of and the accumulating forces for the revolution that we're actually preparing.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Noche Diaz from the Revolution Club, and he is currently touring the country as part of the Get Into the Revolution National Organizing Tour. And Noche was viciously assaulted recently and arrested by the University of Chicago police, and he has since been banned for life from the grounds of the University of Chicago.
Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you, I mean, this is all very important what you're talking about, and I really wanted to, you know, it's obviously also striking sort of, it's striking a blow, and a blow that's very important and a blow that's being taken very serious by the other side. And just recently, you mentioned that you were arrested on October 22nd by the Chicago Police Department. And then a few days later, you were also arrested and pretty violently assaulted at the University of Chicago. Can we talk about that?
Sure, we can. Yeah, October 22nd, you know, is the 21st. Annual National Day of Protest against police brutality, repression, and criminalization of the generation, and all the police brutality and repression was on full display that day in Chicago. And you know, we had this permit, which, you know, said we could march in the street two lanes of traffic, and they violated that permit on two counts. You know, as I said in a press conference, the permit clearly said no live animals, but the city of Chicago decided to send out dozens of pigs to harass, intimidate, and terrorize the march and protesters. And, you know, these were people, again, whose loved ones had been murdered by the police already, who themselves had been tortured by the police in their torture chambers. So this is another thing in Chicago that's, you know, unique about Chicago, or it is, well, not so unique, but in terms of what's being exposed about Chicago, is the massive torture chambers that were running this city for decades and decades. And there's this big expose online now in the Atlantic, 10,000 documents, you know, detailing all of this. But this is the kind, you know, these are the kinds of people who were at this march and were came under attack, and the message of stopping police terror and brutality, and the messengers of the mighty, mighty RevComs right there in the face of this, saying, we're going to lead people to put an end to this system, and we're here to organize people into the ranks of this revolution. Going down the Miracle Mile on the streets was not something that they wanted in this kind of a situation where they're very vulnerable. And this is something that we've very much wanted, and we were able to accomplish on a certain level with the march, even though it was repressed. People didn't back down and just cow in the face of that, and they actually used that to bring more people into what people were doing on that day, into the sidewalk, unfortunately. But, you know, opposing in the face of this attack, that people are going to still actually come out even stronger in the face of all this. And, you know, and then, as you said, you know, just days later after getting out on the University of Chicago, which, by the way, for people listening should know, there's been a whole hoopla that's been made about the fact that the president has insisted that this is a university that where freedom of speech is welcome and there's no safe spaces for students because they should be challenged by different ideas. And on the day that we were there, it happened to also be the day where John Kerry, this more liberal war criminal, was invited onto campus to speak, you know, about his great negotiating skills in the favor of empire. I mean, it just, you know, invokes imagery of the Godfather and giving offers can't refuse, you know, running a criminal empire that the largest military in the world that destroys and bombs and brutalizes people and then negotiating with all these other forces on its behalf. Come on, this is a war criminal, a person who's an operative for an empire. He was invited to speak, and in the midst of that, we were calling him out, and then talking to the students about, you know, this revolution, how America was never great and we need to overthrow, not vote for it. First of all, we were, you know, assaulted and attacked by this student who was a venomous, you know, America's is number one. I don't know who he was or what his old background was, but he wasn't just anybody. He was a very venomous, you know, hatred towards myself and one of the other, you know, a couple of the other people there who he's grabbed and threatened. And then, you know, then after that, the security comes. And what do they do as we're leaving, after making this announcement, after talking to the students, as we're leaving, you know, we're brutally attacked by this security pig, university pig, which is under the district of the Chicago police, for people, you know, to understand. And we're thrown around, you know, myself, I'm grabbed, and he has nothing to say except, well, I was told to arrest you. And then even as I let go, and then I was walking out of the building, and then again, he runs up behind me and says, no, wait, I was told to arrest you. And they have nothing to say about why. They have no, you know, nothing to bring against me except, you know, I was told to arrest you, and I'm tossed around. People can go on revcom.us and see the videos of all this too, by the way. You know, I'm tussled around. You know, in the course of all of this, you know, the one of the comrades who was with us, you know, a young woman was brutally assaulted and sent to the hospital. This is all in plain view of all the students. Even one of the students took a video, and it ended up on the Maroon, you know, front page of their website, which is the campus newspaper. Now, just this vicious assault, while this war criminal is speaking, this revolutionary is speaking about getting free of all this oppression and madness, and, you know, dragged down, and all these claims, and, you know, they're, one of the claims they tried to bring up was, it's, you know, inappropriate to stand on the table and make such an announcement. But, you know, I have to say, if I stood on that table and made an announcement about how the Chicago Cubs are going to win the World Series, the whole room would have joined me on top of the table and chanting, and Rahm Emanuel probably would have came down and gave me the key to this city. So this had nothing to do with that. It had to do with the message that we were there to bring and who was bringing that message. This is no accident. The RevCons are known in Chicago and actually throughout the country more and more, becoming known by the authorities too much and not enough of the broad masses who actually want and need this revolution and want to know about it. But the authorities know that the RevCons represent a danger to them holding all of this together. They see it in potential. It's not realized yet, but they see it in potential. And this is something that they've worked to try to contain, isolate, and undermine before it even gets going and gets started. And this is just the getting started of the tour.
Mm-hmm. All right, Noche, on that note, I want to ask you real quick. We have about 2 minutes for you to just say if there's some final closing thoughts you have and you want to tell people where they can go to find out more about this. And Noche, and as well, you know, you should let people know that you are part of the Revolution Club too. And that's, you know, part of something that people should be looking to and looking to find wherever they are. Start wherever they are, whatever's going on. But how about giving people a couple of minutes of what now?
Sure. So, yeah, I am part of the Revolution Club, and I spoke briefly earlier about our point of attention. But in short, look, as I started, if you want to make a revolution, you got to get organized for a revolution. And these clubs are where people go to fight the power today, to stop the crimes of this system, and learn about the new communism of Bob Avakian, which is the science and leadership we have to make this revolution and to build a new society, to lead a new society, not just walk away after the revolution, but to actually build a new society on the road to real emancipation. People can connect up with the tour, which is now in Chicago, but which will be going around the country, and also invite us to different places or try to come out and meet up with the tour and hook up and get connected up into the revolution by emailing us at getintotherevolution@gmail.com. And a lot of this is available all on www.revcom.us. And since Sara Taylor has been, you know, has a Twitter account, and she's been, you know, posting regularly updates on what the tour is involved in and doing, you know, regularly. And I encourage people to follow Sara Taylor at Twitter. I don't know how you actually do that. I'm sure if you just Google Sara Taylor at Twitter, you'll find it.
And we'll put it up on our website as well. So she's got regular on that. All right, Noche, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And we'll have you back to keep up on this, man. We want to follow this as it unfolds, because it is a tour that's going to be lasting for, what, a year, right?
That's right. Yeah. It will be a year. And I also encourage people to check out the website. You know, today, tomorrow, there should be an announcement about some follow-up and ways to actually be part of the fight against the charges that have been brought against us here, and specifically the attack on the University of Chicago while we were there. And I forgot to mention, I've been given a trespass warning, basically a ban from the campus. I'm not allowed to enter there without facing the threat of being attacked and arrested for criminal trespassing.
Damn. Yeah, well, definitely keep us posted on that one, man. All right? Yeah. All right, Noche, thank you very much, man. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right, have a good one, man.
You too, man.
Appreciate
you. Sure. Take care, man. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Noche Diaz about what's been going on with the tour that he's on, a tour that's going to last for a year, and it's Get Into the Revolution National Organizing Tour. And he was viciously assaulted and arrested by University of Chicago police on Wednesday, October 26th, delivering the message that America was never great. We need to overthrow, not vote for this system. All right, and he's, as you heard, he's talking about this is a movement for revolution, and he's calling on people to plug into it, to become part of it, all right? And I think actually people need to think about that, how refreshing it is to actually hear a voice like that that's talking about the reality, not just the reality of what we face, but what we need to do about it. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with the directors, co-directors and of the film, The Ruins of Lifta, where the Holocaust and the Nakba meet. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That's Palestine from Peter Liam Hallcross. Joining us now, actually, I was recently turned onto a film that just, I put it on late at night and I watched it once. And then a little while later, I watched it again. And then just this morning, I watched it again because I was just that into it. I mean, I really learned a lot from this film. And the film, as I was saying, is called The Ruins of Lifta, Where the Holocaust and the Nakba Meet. And it's directed by Aaron Rudofsky.
Aaron Rudofsky, you're pretty close.
Okay. And Menachem Daum?
Yes, how are you?
Good, how are you? You're going to have to speak up when you do it, okay?
Okay, sure.
All right, before we begin the conversation, let's take a listen to the trailer for the film Ruins of Lifta, Where the Nakba and the Holocaust Meet.
In a valley at the entrance to Jerusalem lies Lifta, the only Arab village abandoned in 1948, which has not been completely destroyed or repopulated. Lifta is now threatened by a development plan for luxury villas that would forever erase its Arab history. The story told by Lifta's ruins and by the people who once lived here challenges the views I inherited as the son of Holocaust survivors. It is here that I brought together a Holocaust survivor with a refugee expelled from this village.
Why I should suffer? Why I should pay the price
for
the thing that others did?
In my family, I'm lucky. Out of 20 people, I'm alive. Okay? So I'm supposed to go back and rebuild my life in a country where everybody was killed? They had a war against the Jewish people, not just against...
What happened here against Palestinian people?
Nobody wanted to kill you.
Why? They killed.
No, they did not.
Why not? Where is my father? Where is my father?
He was killed in the war.
As you have the right to go back home, I have the right to go back home.
This is your home.
But I haven't the right to come here.
The possibility that my parents' Holocaust suffering has distorted my view of the conflict has led me to this place. Each side of the conflict clings to their narrative, the Holocaust or the Nakba, the Palestinian exile. But must we really choose between one or the other?
All right, welcome back. That was the trailer for the film Ruins of Lifta, Where the Nakba and the Holocaust Meet. Oren, why don't we start with you? Why don't you tell people what the film about Lifta is?
Well, what very few people know is where Lifta is and what it is. And it's this exquisitely beautiful and abandoned Palestinian village, which is right on the outskirts of Jerusalem. Many, many people have visited Jerusalem over the years and very, very few of them have even heard of Lifta, even though it is important place archaeologically and historically, and also a beautiful spot, and there's a lot of reasons for that, I'm sure, and our hope is to correct that before it's too late. We want people to know about what happened there, and we want people to know about it as a place of hope, actually, even though it's hard to believe.
And Aaron, I think you should mention the threat facing Lifta right now at this very moment.
What are they?
Yes, absolutely. Lifta, we had thought, and the film goes into some detail about the fact that there had been a reprieve on Lifta being developed into a luxury condo area, which will primarily or only be available to Jews, and it won't be completely destroyed, as some of the buildings will remain, but any of its character will be destroyed. And we just heard today that even though there was a reprieve, that it's going to go back on the market for developers in December unless something dramatic happens to make that stop.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want people to know, understand too, more on that, is that Lifta is actually, it's the only Arab village abandoned in the 1948 Arab-Israeli War that has not been completely destroyed or repopulated by Jews, as we were saying earlier. But it's the place that caused Menachem to question things that he had been told his whole life. Menachem, let's talk about that a little. What happened there that made you question everything?
Yeah, I was raised by two survivors of the Holocaust whose faith in mankind was severely affected by the trauma that they experienced. And basically, they left Poland with very harsh, judgmental feelings of their former Polish countrymen. And I was kind of raised to see all Poles as incorrigible anti-Semites. And basically, that was the subject of our previous film, Hiding and Seeking, in which I did wind up going back to Poland against my parents' wishes, first in 89, but then subsequent, and found that there are all kinds of people in Poland, and that the broad brush with which I had painted them as a result of my parents' Holocaust experiences was an overgeneralization. There was good, bad, and you know, in between. And I was amazed to find that there were wonderful people in Poland, and that made me question the inheritance of the view of others that I had grown up with. And next to the Poles, my parents also had very little affection or for Palestinians or Arabs in general, whom they looked upon as trying to finish the work that Hitler had left undone. And that's the way I was raised, to look at all Palestinians. But once I realized that the Holocaust had distorted my view of Poles, I also started asking myself if it had distorted my view of Palestinians. And that's when I decided to do something I had never done before, and actually take the measure of Palestinians and try to befriend them. And the first Palestinian that I attempted to befriend happened to be Yaqub Oda, a refugee of Lifta, and the person who's leading the campaign to save his village from the development plan. And that's basically the background to our film.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me something. The subtitle to the film is the point of where Holocaust and Nakba meet. What's behind that?
Well, these are the two mega narratives that drive the conflict on each side. And each side clings to their narrative of victimhood and oppression. And basically, those are such powerful mega narratives that they preclude perhaps looking with some sympathy and understanding at the other's position. And in a way, what I think that the film is trying in some way to say is that we don't necessarily have to pick one narrative at the expense of the other narrative, but we can open up our hearts and minds to be sympathetic to both of these tales of suffering that both peoples have endured, and that the suffering of one doesn't necessarily justify inflicting suffering on the other.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Menachem Daum and Oren Rudofsky. They are the filmmakers of the film The Ruins of Lifta, where the Holocaust and the Nakba meet.
Now, Oren, tell me this, because, you know, again, one of the things about the film that really struck me a lot was that, you know, there's this whole question of, and I think Menachem's been speaking to this, but the point about that's often raised in the film by many people, that the horror of the Holocaust is important to talk about, but it's also used to justify unleashing other horrors against the Palestinian people. And one of the things that actually really struck me was that there's a point there, there's a presentation where I think there's a lot of people who, let me put it this way, I think one of the people who first became friends with Menachem, and I think it was said that it was his first, it was your first Palestinian friend, was Yaqub Odeh.
Yeah, and, correct.
Yeah, and it was very interesting because here's a man who, he wasn't saying, you know, it's not like choose one narrative over the other, but there was and a constant repetition of this in many different ways. One thing is what happened to Jewish people in Europe and around the world in various places, and it was horrendous and it was a crime against humanity. But then there's also what's happened to the Palestinian people, which is a horrendous and a crime against humanity. And there's people who keep bringing that up in a way of saying, look, whenever it's mentioned that, well, the Holocaust, that's why we're here. The Holocaust, that's why we came here. And the Palestinians, and Yaqub in particular, will say, what does what happened to you in Poland have to do with what was going on in Palestine? It's a question that keeps getting posed a lot of different ways. And I thought it was a really important thing to be raised in the film. And maybe both of you can speak, but let's hear from...
Sure. I've been to Israel many times, as has Menachem, and one of the rationales, of course, which, I mean, I do consider myself a Zionist. I do believe that the Jews needed a place to call home. And I do believe that the history of the Jewish people has been one where they haven't had a place. Now, of course, one could argue, and argue correctly, that the United States has become a safe home and haven for Jews, as it has been for hundreds of years. On the other hand, one could argue that Germany and Poland was that place for an even longer period of time. So the argument of Jews who are Zionists is that the only possible place where Jews could have safety in a homeland is Palestine. The problem, as we know, with that argument is that sometimes people are blind to other realities when they have a dream and an idealism that does not, and fears that they don't see that they're jumping out of a burning building and landing on somebody else's head. And that is what Yaqub Odeh is talking about, is sure, I agree that the Nazis were evil and they did terrible things to you, but why did you, and frankly with the aid of Europeans and Americans and UN declaration, pick us? Why did you pick Palestine? And furthermore, why weren't you sensitive to the fact that we have our own right to this land? Why haven't you been more sensitive to that? And in 1948, the Nakba, which is for Palestinians, the catastrophe is for the Jews, or for Zionist Jews, the War of Independence. So therein lies the conflict and what Yaqub so eloquently brings up.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because when it surprised me to hear you describe yourself as a Zionist, and because exactly what you're saying is that through the film, most of what's presented is that, look, the Palestinian people, there were Jewish people who came and lived in Palestine with the Palestinian peoples and lived in Palestine. And then there was this whole thing of what happened in Europe and what was concentrated there. And also, Ilan Pappé has written tremendous amounts of work about that, very scholarly work, books about the origins of Zionism in relation to Palestine and what's happened there. And I was really moved by this fact that at every turn, actually, your film sort of even, and particularly this was concentrated in The Historian, who Menachem, I have to... Yeah, and I had to really admire Menachem, your openness to, when you were talking to this guy, and he was very patiently shaking his head and saying, no, you've got this wrong. And this was an Israeli historian who was arguing that, look, what happened to the Jewish people was a crime against humanity, but you can't resolve that by taking away the homeland of a whole other people and doing similar things to those people.
I just want to say one thing before Menachem speaks. I just want to say, when I call myself a Zionist, there are different kinds of Zionists. And the Zionism that I believe in, I don't think it should be purely painted as a dirty word, because I believe that there are Zionists who are idealists who hoped and believed that they could form a connection, a political homeland alongside Palestinians that would not displace them. That form of Zionism seems to have lost out. But so I don't consider it purely a dirty word. I think there's an idealistic vision there as well that is become harder and harder to maintain.
Well, and there's good reason for it to become harder and harder to maintain, but we'll have to discuss that at another time. Menachem, I want to hear from you about the historian, because again, it's one of those points where you can see in your face and you can see in the questions you're asking and your reaction to what he's saying, there's actually a lot that is being challenged in your own beliefs and experience, but you're very open to it.
Yeah, one of the characters in the film is my uncle, who had always been my hero and through whom I had viewed the history of Palestine, Israel, most of my life. He was most of my family, both my father's and mother's side, they were practically the only survivors of their families. But my uncle, even as a young man in the late 30s, saw that there was no future for Jews in Europe, and he was reading about Palestine and got enamored. He gave up the Hasidism and religious lifestyle that he had been raised with and rebuilt, and became a Hasid of Jabotinsky's efforts to use brigades to reclaim Palestine for Jews. He kind of almost ran away from home in 1936-37, and he made an illegal immigration to Palestine to help create a Jewish country. And one of the historians in the film, Hillel Cohen, kind of makes it very clear and brings to make it the point that I did not realize. He pointed out that for many, many centuries, the Muslim world invited Jews to settle in Palestine and in the Ottoman Empire. That when Jews were being expelled from Christian countries, particularly Spain and Portugal, the Muslims welcomed them. In fact, the Muslims couldn't understand why the Christian countries were kicking out some of their most productive citizens and invited them. And Jews did live under Muslim rule for many years and had a place in there. And I'd always thought that Jews and Muslims were sort of like fire and water, cats and dogs, but he dispelled that notion, the historian Hillel Cohen, but he pointed out the difference between earlier immigrations to Muslim countries and the case of my uncle was that my uncle didn't come to become part of the existing Ottoman Empire or Muslim order. He came to change the existing order. I mean, I realize my uncle did not come to Palestine in 1938 with a little Arabic dictionary trying to figure out how to become a good citizen of Palestine. He came with the intention of taking over and creating a Jewish homeland. Mm-hmm. And this was something that was made clear to me by one of the historians in the film.
Yeah, and it's a very moving moment. Now, unfortunately, guys, I got to wrap this up, but I wanted to thank you both very much for the film and, again, for coming onto the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Take care now. This is the Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Menachem Daum and Oren Radofsky, the filmmakers of Lifta, where the Nakba and the Holocaust meet. And like I said at the beginning, it's a very interesting film, and you can actually go and find out more about it, including how you can get to see it, by going to their website, which is Ruins of Lifta, that's L-I-F as in Frank, T as in Tom, A, .wordpress.com. All right, we've got some time left in today's show, and with elections coming up so soon and lots of people agonizing over it, I want to play a segment with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Cornel West. Now, this is a segment called Is There a Value to Voting? Can Voting Stop Fascism? And I'll tell you, I wanted to play this because people are really confronting some very big things in the world today. The state of the world, what's happening to people all over the world, what the future holds, and what we can do to deal with all that, to change all that in a way that would actually benefit humanity. So I decided to run this piece again, and it's taken from Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian.
Someone asks, in response to voting, is there no value in working to abolish a system while participating to minimalize the immediate damage it does at the same time? And then someone else asked, if we avoid voting because no candidate represents the left, how can we also avoid enabling the rise of the worst of the right?
Now, I think Brother Bacon said it well when he said he's not against fighting for the right to vote. And under certain circumstances, voting might make a difference. He just doesn't want to trot out the illusion that somehow we can vote our way through fundamental social change. I think it was Emma Goldman who used to say, if you could vote, if voting would lead towards fundamental transformation, it would be illegal. So we're not against reform. We fight for reform. We're not seduced by the illusions of reform. That's all. Is that a characterization of what you were talking about?
Yeah, but I think there's another, yes, but I also think there's another point here, which is the logic of the vote of voting forgets one very basic fact, that in any kind of profound social change that's come about, it didn't come about by people playing by the rules and going along with the way things are. It went by people stepping outside of the way things are and refusing to go along with the rules. If you think about, for example, even some of the gains of the civil rights movement, the way things were in the South was, it wasn't just something people, white people didn't want, that black people could go to a restaurant. It was against the law.
That's right.
The law said that you had to have segregation. So if you were gonna change that, you couldn't say we have to abide by the law. You have to say this law is an unjust law. We have to step outside and oppose that. And if you think about any kind of basic change that's been brought about, it's always happened. See, people say, for example, now I got to call his name, Michael Eric Dyson. In the last presidential election, said, well, if you don't vote, then you aren't in the game. The championship is the San Antonio Spurs and the Miami Heat. If you don't support one of those two teams, then you don't have it. You're not involved. You don't have a dog in the fight. The problem is, if the choices that they're giving us are the only way you can play the game, then that ought to tell us that we don't need to be playing this game. See, that's the first thing. And what we need to do, like people have always done whenever they've changed anything in any kind of fundamental way, is to step outside of the rules. Like, let's go back to right now, what's hanging in the air, the Michael Brown thing. How many times have you heard over and over again, well, we have to respect the process. We have to let the system play out. We have to let the system work. But this is the system working. The assassination of Michael Brown and so many others, thousands of others, that is the system working. And, look, how many times going back, say, 50, 60, 70 years, were black people lynched in the South? And thousands of times. And how many times was any white person ever convicted of murdering them in that way? Now, you can come forward to the present time. People always say, well, the police have such a dangerous job. Look, what about all the police that are killed by black people? Well, what about them? First of all, you can't hardly find any. You go and take the statistics for the number of police that have been killed over the last 30 years and put it up against the number of black youth and brown youth that have been killed by the police, and one of them will be like this and the other one will be like that. And then here's the other thing. If somebody black or brown does kill somebody in the police, how long are they gonna live? And if they live, how long is a grand jury gonna take, if it even goes to the grand jury, to indict them for murder? Take the list of the number of police that have ever been indicted and tried, let alone convicted, for killing one of these youth, and put it up against the number of youth who've been indicted and convicted and either executed or sent to life in prison for the few times that they have actually killed the police. So this is the setup you're dealing with, and this goes back to elections. The problem with the elections is that the terms are always set by the powers that be, by the system itself, in a way that always makes the choices get worse and worse. So that what yesterday was something that you regarded as an outrage, tomorrow that becomes a compromise position, and the day after that it becomes the best thing you can hope for under this system and by voting. And this is what's wrong with the whole thing of voting. We have to go out and change the terms, not try to find the best we can within the terms.
I think this raises an issue which in some ways is the elephant in the room now, which is very much like the Sinclair Lewis novel. You said what? Oh, you can't hear? What? I can't hear. Oh, hit him where it hit. Well, the economic boycott that we called for in New York just 2 weeks ago, to end stop and frisk and to have the resignation of Bratton. Yeah, economic boycott, yes. But what I was talking about was this, though. Whoever raised their voice like that, it sound good. I think in beyond that, we have to come to terms with the fact that there is a real possibility that America could go outright fascist. Mm-hmm. We got to come to terms with that. And what that means is that when you have politicians who are bought off by big money, bought off by big banks, bought off by big corporations, so that the government itself is completely subsumed under the power of Wall Street and big corporations. And those voices that are raised to try to bring critique to bear are either demonized, character assassination, or literal assassination, America is then very much on the road to fascism. And, well, no. The very fact that we're having this dialogue here is in some sense a possibility of some people speaking their minds. I'm talking about when just to raise your very voice, my dear sister, means you shut down like a dog. We can call it soft fascism versus hard fascism. Okay. So by raising voices, by still having possibility of social movements, even though it's penetrated by the FBI, that's soft fascism, then you got thick fascism. But I don't want to play with the word fascism because many of us have had to deal with much more harder fascism where we couldn't raise our voices at all. You see? But I'm just saying that because when you look at the three dominant tendencies of neoliberal capitalism, which is financialized, privatized, and militarized, and the financializing with wealth at the top, you're privatizing public education, public life, public prisons across the board, and then you militarize them, beginning with the schools and the airports, let alone the bombs in 890 military units around the world with a ship in every ocean. That is the American empire at the moment. At the moment. And to the degree to which the very possibilities of public spaces where certain voices, let alone certain movements, can still be enacted. Because believe me, under fascism, Revolutionary Communist Party would not exist at all.
Well,
we
wouldn't be here, sitting here.
Well, we would be underground and in a serious way. That might be the case that there's a whole lot of folks underground. But I mean, the point is that I'm just talking about that's one of the elephants in the room in regard to what the challenges are.
Well, I agree, and I think the point once again is that there's only one way that's going to be prevented, and that's the same way that everything else we're talking about is going to happen. It's people rising up and refusing to go along with it and winning more and more people. Look, we have to go, when we talk about transforming the people, we're talking about, it's not some mystical process. We're talking about transforming the thinking of people, large numbers of people, how people understand the reality out here, what their values are based on that, how they see going about things in the world, what they think is important, how they see the possibility of living a different way, and how they see going about fighting for that. But this is the key thing we have to do. We can't just have a good dialogue, and believe me, I'm enjoying it very much. And it's very important, and we need to do a lot more of this. You and me need to do more of this, and other people need to do more of this. We need to be, our agreements, our disagreements, we need to be wrestling with them. Right. We need to find the unity as broadly as we can, and we need to keep talking about and arguing about our disagreements in a principled and lofty way. But at the same time, we can't just come to a thing and feel good for ourselves. This is not about us. This is not about the people here just unto ourselves.
That's right.
This is about what kind of world we're going to have and what we're really willing to do to actually fight to bring that world into being and to live in a way that's consistent with that and to bring into being a world that we can give to our children and their children that's much different and much better than this world. So we have to go out of here. That's why I said, and I was very serious. I'm not playing here. If they don't bring down an indictment against the murderer of Michael Brown, that is a test for all of us, and that is a test for this society and the people in it. What kind of society are we going to live in? What kind? It's not the only one. There are many tests, but it's one right in front of us right now.
Okay.
And if we're gonna prevent, look, if the rulers of this country think that they have to throw off their democratic mask and go to what you're calling thick fascism, go to outright dictatorial rule without any pretense of allowing for the will of the people and rights and protests and so on, if they come to a consensus, maybe through a lot of struggle in their own ranks, but if they come to a consensus that that's what they need, they're going to move in that way. And nothing will stop them but us. And the millions and millions of people who are like us or who are not like us, but need to be one to understand the world the way that we're coming to understand it.
Well, that's real. That's real.
All right, once again, that was a little piece called Is There a Value to Voting? Can Voting Stop Fascism? And it was taken from Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And you can access the entire dialogue at revcom.us. All right, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Noche Diaz from the Revolution Club and the Get Into the Revolution National Organizing Tour. I also want to thank Menachem Daum and Oren Radofsky, the filmmakers of The Ruins of Lifta, where the Holocaust and the Nakba meet. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Kiana Williams. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, we're going to go out now with a little piece from Curtis Mayfield. People, get ready. Talk to you again next week.
Just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers honing. Don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train to join.